And welcome to another edition of Soundography. It's a crash course in popular music, one band at a time. I am one of your humble instructors here. My name is Brian Ibbett.
And I am Hammond Chamberlain.
And this week, hallelujah, we're finally getting to Leonard Cohen for our fourth episode here. Yeah, Leonard Cohen, who, kind of like I alluded to just there, a guy who probably everybody knows for one song, maybe a couple of songs, but it's that one song that people know by him that people may not even have heard his version of it, right? I mean, they've heard Rufus Wainwright's version. They've heard John Cale's version from Shrek, I believe.
Yeah.
Or the numerous, or of course, the Buckley, the Jeff Buckley version, which is a favorite cover among people. But with the exception of one movie where it's used very awkwardly, maybe have never heard the original Leonard Cohen version.
You know, this is interesting for me because he is going to be one of those guys we talk about as a songwriter. And we've done this a couple times. We talked about John Popper's evolution as a storyteller in song.
Right.
Eddie Vedder, we covered the same thing.
For sure.
And even Alan Parsons, we talked about how they use a lot of their literary references to build their songs. Mm-hmm. But this guy, because of his history, it really does play into how much he cares about the word.
Yes. Yes. Words, it's apparent in his music that the lyric is the thing. You know, it's like the Shakespeare quote, the play is the thing. Mm-hmm. And the same is with Leonard Cohen, is that it's the written word, or it's the words. His voice, as it is more, you know, merely just a vessel for getting those words into people's ears, or his books, his poetry, just a way to deliver those words to people's eyes. So
this one is a hard one for me because there was so little variance in his voice. He actually and to me, he kind of makes Johnny Cash seem dynamic.
Yeah.
And then there are times where he sounds like Mark Knopfler that was on a 45 slowed down to 33.
Well, it's funny because as we're talking about his albums, I think there was a very defined moment somewhere between 1979 and 1984 where his voice went from being the worst part of his music for me to being one of the best parts of his music.
I think someone got a hold of him, a producer or someone, mm-hmm. and kind of taught him how to use that to the best of it, to stay within those limits and to make the best of it. The one thing I want to know is who does his arranging and who works with him musically.
Right.
Because what they do is he's like a beat poet. He's got all this great music underneath him, and he's spitting out some, I mean, if this were modern day vernacular, he's spitting out some serious rhymes.
Yes.
And it's this really heartfelt, meaningful stuff. Mm-hmm. But the music underneath is just almost, it's like bed music sometimes.
It's Casio. It's basically like, almost like those built-in rhythms and melodies that you get in a Casio keyboard.
Yeah.
There are times when you're thinking, all right, this was the demo track. Where's the real where's the real one with real instruments? And it's funny because you go all the way until 2004 to his Dear Heather album before you start hearing nothing but real instruments. Mm-hmm. There are songs on 10 New Songs where you're hearing a trumpet sound from a keyboard. And it's so blaringly obvious mm-hmm. that you know Leonard Cohen has got to have enough pull to get a real trumpeteer to play in his band.
Yeah, he's been recognized by the Canadian government. You think someone like that could get a real horn?
Right.
Especially
in
Canada.
because it's so noticeable. I mean, it's, you know, there's no wavering in the tone. It is somebody pressing the key and then releasing the key. And there's no like slow fade out that you'd maybe get with a trumpet or that kind of variance that you'd get with an analog sound versus a digital sound. But, you know, when you're a lyricist, like Leonard Cohen, maybe that's not important to you. Yeah. You know, maybe it's not, it's apparent by everything that you see about the guy that, as long as his words are coming across, as long as his message and his meaning are coming across, he really doesn't care, about how the rest of it's delivered.
And
I'm sure he cares enough to know, to make sure it's not garbage.
I actually think that's one of the strong suits with him is the fact that I think he knows he doesn't have the world's strongest voice.
Yeah.
But I think he's also aware that he has some serious writing skills.
Right.
And that covers up for a ton of other errors or problems.
For sure.
I mean,
man, I maybe wouldn't want to have the singing voice. I would love to have his speaking voice as of, 1984 and after, because that voice is just, I'd get voiceover work jobs up the wazoo with that voice. The new infinity.
Yeah. So let's go back a little bit.
And sure.
So Leonard Cohen was inducted into the Canadian Music Hall of Fame, the Canadian Songwriters Hall of Fame, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and was given the champion of the Order of Canada, which is like the highest civilian honor.
Like the Order of the British Empire, the OBE is in the UK, right? The equivalent of that, right?
And then they've also listed him as one of the most influential songwriters of all time, right up there with Dylan and Paul Simon. Mm-hmm. And after listening for the last 2 weeks intensely to all of his stuff, once I was able to get beyond some of the synthesized music and
the vocals and
lack of vocal variants, I started listening to what he had to say. A lot of the stuff is really, really, really good. And I understand how and why he got all this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. His narration, his descriptions, his
just
ability to
choice.
Create an atmosphere. Yes. And there's so many points at which, you could be clever and you could be witty and puns and stuff like that. And he manages to do what he does without any sort of double entendre. I mean, it is you're getting poetry basically, and it's really, really well written. And I'm such a lyrics guy, obviously. I pay attention to lyrics. I remember before, back in the days when I had time, I'd come home with a brand new album. I'd take the plastic off. I'd open up the turntable or open up the CD drawer. I would put the disc in, and then I would lay on the couch and read along with the liner notes, read the lyrics on the liner notes as I heard the album for the first time. And that set basically any future listenings to that album. I had that groundwork of like, oh yeah, this is that song where they're talking about what it's like to be a kitchen table and there really isn't a song by the Beautiful South called The Table. But, I'm serious. There really is.
No, I get it. And just like when you think about that, there's a band called Billy Pilgrim that came out in late 90s. Yeah. And they have a song where they actually they reference the sound of your bare feet on the kitchen floor.
Right.
And it's funny, until they use that phrase, I had actually never thought about that noise.
Right. But it's a very distinct noise.
But now, every time I'm barefoot on the kitchen floor, I think about that song.
Yeah. Billy Pilgrim. Didn't he had a song called Get Me Out of Here?
Uh-huh, right? They did.
Is that his single? Yep, I totally remember Billy Pilgrim.
Let's talk about his discography.
Yes. Okay. Because there is absolutely, I would say, phase one Leonard Cohen, phase two Leonard Cohen, and I think even we're starting to enter into, we're about two albums into phase three Leonard Cohen, I think.
Now, when I first started doing the research on this, I got very, very concerned about his naming convention. Because it reminded me of a Mighty Wind.
Right.
A joke from Mighty Wind, and if you aren't familiar with it, then go watch the movie. The first album was in 1967 called Songs of Leonard Cohen.
Uh-huh.
And then in 1969, he had Songs from a Room.
Right.
And then in 1971, he did Songs of Love and Hate.
Right.
And I'd already typed in songs of after 1974, but he didn't change. He changed his naming convention.
Changed his style. Hey, look, Peter Gabriel, first four Peter Gabriel albums were called Peter Gabriel.
Yes.
Not even Peter Gabriel 1, 2, 3, and 4, just Peter Gabriel. So, and I rank Peter Gabriel up there as one of,
he's awesome.
50 best songwriters of all time, too. Maybe 25 best songwriters. But, and he doesn't, he may have gotten out of that mode for a couple of them, for New Skin of the Old Ceremony and Death of a Ladies Man. But then 79 recent songs.
Yes. And then Various Positions, which has, you mentioned the double entendre aspect of him. That's one that kind of has it, because it could be musical positions, like on a keyboard or the way you play structure chords, or it could be the other various positions.
Well, sexual, right? Yeah. But then also the various points of view, like taking a position on this or taking a position on that. Yeah. And it is a very clever title.
And it shows you how he uses the word, because that really, what I've learned about this, my big takeaway from this episode and listening to his stuff is how important each word was to him. If you want a partner, and then in 88, he did I'm Your Man. Or if you want to strike me down in anger, here I stand, I'm your man.
If you want a boxer, in 92 is The Future. Such a great album. That was the first album I'd ever heard. I was friends with a woman named Angel back in late 80s, 1988, 89. And she said, oh, you've got to check out this album. And I'm trying to look up and see when the movie Pump Up the Volume came out. I want to say it was like 92.
I thought it was earlier than that.
Was it? Maybe.
I thought it was still when I was in high school, which makes it 88, 89.
1990. Okay. So
90. Okay.
90. And so she says, oh yeah, you got to check this guy's album out. And I'm listening to it, and it's like, this guy's got this really cool, bassy, deep voice, but it really sounds like he's singing with a Casio tone. I mean, for that first song, First We Take Manhattan, it feels like five people on Casio's playing.
Yeah, the Casio 100 that they, that you'd just sit and play with in the store for 5 minutes, 5-10 minutes.
But I listened to the album two or three times all the way through. And the first time, same kind of thing. It was back when I had time, so I got to read the lyrics while it was going on. And Everybody Knows was just fantastic. And First We Take Manhattan and I'm Your Man and Jazz Police, or not Jazz Police, Take This Waltz. Well, Jazz Police is on there, but Jazz Police is my least favorite song on the album. But Take This Waltz and Tower of Song, especially Tower of Song. What a great album closing that is. My rent every day in the Tower of Song. I said to Hank Williams, how lonely does it get? Hank Williams hasn't answered yet, but I hear him coughing. And I was hooked. And 2 years later, I'm watching Christian Slater's Pump Up the Volume, which probably had something to do with me wanting to get in podcasting.
It's all Christian Slater's fault, folks.
It is. It's right. You can blame his Greetings and Salutations all over that place. But Everybody Knows comes on, and first you hear the Leonard Cohen original. I think Christian Slater plays it a couple times for his pirate radio station. And then later on, you hear the Concrete Blonde cover of it. And if I wasn't hooked before then, it's like, all right, that is just fantastic. But it's cool when you hear this thing that's like, you feel like nobody ever heard of this guy before. I had no idea how popular he was for kind of the older crowd, but you hear this thing that nobody had ever, or the nobody you knew had ever told you about, except for this one friend who let you borrow her album. And you hear it in this movie, like, oh my God, that's Leonard Cohen. That's Everybody Knows. How cool.
Yeah.
It's kind of signify how hipster Christian Slater was.
It's always a great moment when you're watching a movie in particular and you recognize a piece of music that they probably don't expect people to recognize.
Right.
Or a new version of a song that yes. you know the original of.
Yes.
And yeah. I guess you and I probably as music nerds probably have that happen more frequently than some other people might. But I always end up elbowing Stacy and going, that's not who really did it. That's so-and-so. And she's, shut up and tell me later. And it happens all the time.
Cool. Yeah. It's so very true. Yeah.
Okay. Then in 92, we have The Future. Mm-hmm. And then and we're back. 10 new songs in 2001.
10 new songs. Right. Exactly. And at least it's an accurate title. It is 10 songs that are new.
Yeah.
So there's that.
And in 2004, they did Dear Heather. And then in 2012, we have Old Ideas. Mm-hmm. And then in 2014, he released Popular Problems. And what makes that stand out is he released that on his 80th birthday.
Right. Yeah.
Which tells you how long he's been doing it, mm-hmm. which tells you the fact that he's still doing it. And yep. it tells you that he's still found ways to be relevant in a time when not only is his style of music, but even like his era of music is having a hard time finding traction.
Totally. Right. Because you've got to basically, when you're Leonard Cohen, you've got to target this album towards people who've been following you and who've got all of your other albums. You're not going to get radio play. I don't think. And you're not going to, it's going to be very hard for you to get new listeners for new people to discover you.
But what you are going to get are people who know other people and say, hey, this is a great song. Maybe take mm-hmm. you and your goofy little band and sit down and try to do a version of it.
Right. Right.
And that's going to be his endearing legacy. I think is the fact that, there are bands out there now who are aging into the lyrics and his storytelling totally. Style, and they're going to bring a new life to this and make his stuff. I mean, 'cause he lays down the perfect blueprints to build songs.
Mm-hmm. And he does.
And as we're going to probably hit on quite a bit later, but almost any style will work with what he's trying to do.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, with people covering him, absolutely. And I think around that same time, like early 90s, 92, 93, I want to say, if not the same year, then certainly in consecutive years, you had two tribute albums that came out, Tower of Song and... Shoot, what was the other one? Wasn't I'm Your Man. That one came out later.
But that movie with I'm Your Man had everybody in it and everyone singing his stuff.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, Nick Cave and Rufus and Martha Wainwright and U2 and such a cool tribute. And that is the thing. That's how you discover an artist like Leonard Cohen, I think, is by hearing his covers. You hear the Jeff Buckley version of Hallelujah. You hear the REM version of First We Take Manhattan, which is really, really good, or the Concrete Blonde version, which is also really good, of Everybody Knows. And then you start finding out that, oh, it's the same guy who does that one as does Hallelujah. Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
And then maybe you go back and you like pick up a like a greatest hits thing, or you pick up a one of his later albums because it's got the original version of Hallelujah, and you discover Dance Me to the End of Love. Mm-hmm. And then you hear the Rufus Wainwright version of that. And it's just such a cool path, all these connections that you make. His music, I'm realizing, has been used so much in films. Obviously we talked about Pump Up the Volume. I briefly touched on the fact that his original version of Hallelujah was used in Watchmen in a very uncomfortable sex scene. his Hallelujah also was in Shrek. That version was Rufus Wainwright. I'm trying to think of where the John Cale version came from. The Future, a few of the songs from Future, Waiting for the Miracle, I Know, The Future, and I think Anthem were used in Natural Born Killers. Mm-hmm. And which is, again, this, you know, this dark kind of complement to his music, I think. True Detective, the horrible second season, they used his Nevermind from his Popular Problems album as the theme. He even did a song for Peaky Blinders, I'm just finding out. And I just watched that season and I didn't catch that, but I'll have to check that out.
I'm getting interested in maybe when Tarantino might use him, because it seems like something that he would use.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, Oliver Stone's using him and Zack Snyder's using him. Sure. I mean, it seems like he's right up that. Maybe he's not kitschy enough for Tarantino.
Maybe. He does like it a little bit more upbeat, but I'm sure he could find, you know, the Crazy 88s doing a cover of something. Right. You mean
First We Take Manhattan?
Yeah.
That'd be, how cool would First We Take Manhattan be by the Crazy 88s? Jeez. Yeah, there you go. That's fantastic.
And he's been a standard in popular culture for such a long time. He hung out with Andy Warhol and his crowd. And he was also in an episode of Miami Vice. If that doesn't show you spanning audiences and spanning range, I don't know what does.
Yeah, for sure. So true. And since the Various Positions album, there's this woman that he's been working with named Anjani Thomas. And Tina and I went out and saw Leonard Cohen at Red Rocks in 2009. Incredible, incredible concert. He played for... Just his main set was an hour and a half to 2 hours. And then he did, I think, 7 encores. Tina and I left after the fourth one, but there's such a long walk to the parking lot from where your seats are at Red Rocks that you can hear all of the other encores while you're walking to your car, and then you beat the traffic.
Also, there's only one road out, so even if you're in your car, roll down your windows, and it's going to be a while.
Yes, you can still hear it. Yes, you're going to be stuck behind people. But it was such an amazing concert. And this woman, Anjani Thomas, he talked about her during the concert. We didn't know what the connection was, but she was the backing vocalist for Hallelujah, all the songs on Various Positions, but you hear her in the background of Hallelujah. And then she became like a constant collaborator with him. And she's even on the cover of his 10 new songs album with him. Mm-hmm. I don't know how, if she's a muse or if she's collaborating more with the music while he focuses on lyrics, or what their arrangement is. But her vocals, there were songs that they performed together at Red Rocks that were normally just him singing, but then she would do like a chorus or she'd do a verse, and just has this great voice that just works so well with his music. And it's such a great, great collaboration.
I love the fact that he brought her in, because he did add a variance and a dynamic.
A softness.
And an interest that wasn't there before, which means that whoever's kind of handling him and helping shape him musically really is doing their best to put his best stuff out.
For sure.
And give him the most traction with what he has as far as tools go. Mm-hmm. He's because, like I said, Johnny Cash is a dynamic singer. He's Bruce Dickinson next to Leonard Cohen.
I would agree with that. Yeah, for sure.
And when he added this woman as a backup singer, it really did add interest. Like, I could tell a change in musical style, dynamic, just all of it. And it made it better. Yeah. Having her along.
Softened it. And maybe that's the thing that happened in 84 that made me enjoy his vocals a lot more. I feel like with some artists, and Johnny Cash is a great one. Johnny Cash will get up on a stage and perform for you. And that is your experience, your relationship with Johnny Cash. I feel like with Leonard Cohen, sure, you know, having seen him perform at Red Rocks is great, but it felt like when you listen to his music, it doesn't feel like somebody on stage performing. It feels like you're sitting at a small round table in a smoky bar with a couple whiskeys in front of you and an ashtray with a cigarette.
Yeah,
smoke wafting above, and he's just telling you a story.
Yeah, like, and you some about neon sign flashing behind him.
Yes, the buzz of like you hear through the window, and he's telling you about this woman he knew at the Chelsea Hotel, he's telling you about.
Has he been on The Simpsons?
Not to my knowledge.
See, that's something I'm surprised at, because that's the kind of thing you'd think they would have done.
I wonder if he would do something like that. He's got such a great voice, like. You'd think you'd see him like doing a voice, maybe not commercial voiceover work, but guest appearances with just his voice.
Yeah.
Maybe it's not something he feels like he wants to do. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, he's always come across as very reclusive.
Yeah.
Lived in Paris for a while.
He lived in Hydra for a while too.
In Hydra?
Yeah.
What?
There's an island he lived on. I think it was called Hydra. Oh.
Really?
It's okay. Off the Greek coast.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's cool. Oh, I think he was a member of Hydra. Like,
like Hail Hydra? No.
Hail Hydra. Hail Hydra.
Your first one was way too dynamic.
Right, exactly. He was in a relationship with Rebecca De Mornay, who, you know, from like Risky Business and The Hand That Rocks the Cradle. And it was during the 90s, she actually produced or helped produce the album, The Future.
Interesting. Thinking about some of the lyrical content, I wonder.
Yes. You want to look through his library and say, all right, which songs?
Yeah.
Highlight for me the songs that are about Rebecca De Mornay. Because you know that everything he writes has got to have some personal, the way he writes, everything has this personal feel. His, you know, again, the Chelsea Hotel song is, I want to say it's a letter to Joni Mitchell. This I should know too. Hold on a second. Oh, wow. Lana Del Rey did a cover of Chelsea Hotel. Refers to a sexual encounter in the Chelsea Hotel, probably New York City's most famous bohemian hostery. Janis Joplin. For some years when performing the song live, Cohen would tell a story that made it clear that the person about whom he was singing was Janis Joplin. He would eventually come to regret his choice to make people aware that the song was about Joplin and the graphic detail in which the song describes their brief relationship. So, yeah, it's about Janis Joplin, but he'd like you not to know that it's about Janis Joplin at this point.
Oops.
Yep. And it's funny because, speaking of covers, he has come out recently and said that he wished people would stop covering Hallelujah.
I can understand
Not his
that.
Other songs. Yeah, totally. Not his other songs. I think he's happy with them, but he probably is like, all right, yeah, that one's gotten enough treatments. You know, have a look. If you want to cover something, I've got 58 other albums of music guys can pick from.
I do think it's kind of ironic that his most popular song is probably one of his least interesting lyrical songs in Hallelujah. I mean, it's got some songs, it's got some lyrical content to it, but there's a lot of repetition, and most of his other stuff doesn't have a lot of repetition. It's a lot of story content, and this one I think is capturing more of a mood or a feeling instead of telling a story, and so therefore it seems to be more simple than... Mm-hmm. And maybe that what leads to it being as popular.
It's a self-referential song too. Hallelujah is a song about the song.
Yeah.
You know, and the minor fourth, the major lift, et cetera. And having it being performed for the king. And there's actually a lost verse of Hallelujah that's floating out there that you can find. And
then it's not lost.
Well, it's not lost, but it doesn't get included in cover versions. He has it in his version, but what's the story with that? Let's see here. According to Anthony Reynolds' 2010 memoir, Leonard Cohen, A Remarkable Life, the pair met at the Royalton on 44th Street in New York so Cohen could play Lissauer his songs, and the producer was surprised. Instead of presenting me with the new songs exclusively on a Spanish guitar as usual, he had this dinky little Casio keyboard with him. Casio was a great discovery for Leonard because these machines allow you to put one finger down and have a whole band come back at you. And this is how he came up with Dance Me to the End of Love.
It's kind of like we had the plot laid out.
Totally. We figured it out before it was even done for us. I want to find the lyric situation, though. It wrote 80 draft verses for Hallelujah.
Man, what was he writing for, Dream Theater?
Right. It was originally like a 45-minute song.
It was like In and I Got It, Evita?
Right. So... the original studio album version, he performed it also in 1985 in his live version, but during the tours, they contained a different set of lyrics with only the last verse being common to the two versions. Singers, numerous cover versions, mix lyrics from both versions and occasionally make direct lyric changes, like Rufus Wainwright changes some of the lyrics. Alison Krauss changes some of the lyrics.
The fifth, the minor fall, the the major lift, the baffled king composing hallelujah. 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 Hallelujah.
And it's so cool to have a song like that that almost has this buffet of verses you can choose from, and you can almost pick the ones you want, right? The, you know, like, all right, I like this lyric, I like this lyric, or this lyric, and then you do your version of Hallelujah with that yeah. match.
It's kind of that's kind of interesting that not only is it something that he allows people to do, because there are people who are very particular about how their songs are covered and if it's note for note or if there's, you know, lyric changes or whatever. And the fact that he allows people to kind of mad lib their way through Hallelujah is a credit to his own confidence in his own lyrics and how much he wants his stuff to be remembered.
Right. Yeah.
Speaking of Hallelujah, sure. Shall we talk about the Stairway to Heaven songs?
Sure. Yes. It kind of falls right into that, right?
Yeah.
I mean, what's cool about that is that you might hear it in concert, but you'll hear it different ways in every concert. You might hear a different set of lyrics in every concert.
Yep.
So can you imagine like Led Zeppelin, you know, Robert Plant going out on tour and doing Stairway to Heaven, and then you hear new verses mixed in with there.
People imagine this
their minds.
And the conspiracies behind that and the meanings.
Oh my
behind
God. What does it mean? Right.
How come
right.
he's saying this verse in Boston and that verse in New York? Does it mean that, you know, one's more evil than the other? Or,
yes.
I mean,
exactly. Oh my God.
Gosh.
That would blow people's minds if
yeah.
they did that. And I was mistaken. Earlier I said that he's tired of it being covered. He actually personally is not tired of being.
He's rolling in Hallelujah money.
Hallelujah money. There's a quote from him. There's been a couple times when other people have said, can we have a moratorium, please, on Hallelujah? Must we have it at the end of every single drama and on every single idol? And once or twice I felt maybe I should lend my voice to silencing it. But on second thought, no, I'm very happy that it's being sung.
Yep, because he's got a giant pile of Hallelujah cash.
This is my Hallelujah Bentley.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, right. So true.
Okay, so I wrote down Hallelujah because it's really the only one of his that I know well enough to call it a Stairway to Heaven song. So what sure. did you provide?
I added three more. I think Suzanne, which was his breakthrough song. I mean, it was the first song that that he released.
He said all men will be sailors then until the sea shall free them. But he himself was broken long before the sky would open. Forsaken, almost human, he sank beneath your wisdom like a stone.
And I don't know if it got radio airplay or how it got discovered, but that was kind of his first song. That's the first thing they include on any Leonard Cohen Greatest Hits album is Suzanne. And then Famous Blue Raincoat. That one and Chelsea Hotel Number 2 both feel like incredibly personal songs to him. And I feel like if you're going to go see Leonard Cohen in concert, he's going to be doing, I think, all four of those: Hallelujah, Suzanne, Raincoat, and Chelsea Hotel.
So which one does he close the show out with? Which is the one that he says, thank you, good night.
Yes, and then comes back for the first encore and does that. Hallelujah.
Yeah.
I'm sure that's it. I'm taking a look now. I love doing this after we come up with our lists.
Yeah.
Setlist.fm. Let's see. Setlist.fm. And I'm going to look up Leonard Cohen, and let's see what his... First, it always blows my mind how many times... 741 recorded... concerts.
Wow.
And let's see here. I like statistics. Artist statistics. All right. Number one song, not one we had on here.
Really?
Bird on the Wire.
Well, I did put that on my list. That's in my...
Yeah, that is...
Yeah.
And it is a great song. I think it's a great song. It's a perfect example of great lyrics. I will enjoy anybody singing it but Leonard Cohen himself.
Yeah, and as I listen to the lyrics, and we kind of talk about some other things we're going to bring in, I realized how fun those lyrics are. which led to my choice in who I want to hear sing it.
Yeah. So you know the most popular cover version, at least the one that I'm thinking of, Katie Lang did a really good version of it, but I think the one... Oh, what?
I was going to say, that sounds good. I could see her doing that.
Yep. And but the version that I think is popular, and I think was even a single, were the Neville brothers, or maybe it was just Aaron Neville solo. And it was for the movie of the same name with Mel Gibson and
Goldie Hawn.
Yes.
Yeah. It's weird that I knew that as rapidly as I did, huh?
Yes, right. You came up with that pretty quickly. I'm not sure about that. Second most popular song for singing in concert is Suzanne.
Okay.
And then Dance Me to the End of Love, Who by Fire, So Long Marianne. Number six is Hallelujah. Famous Blue Raincoat charts in at number 15 and Chelsea Hotel at number 21. So both of those really low on the list. Suzanne, actually, of all the ones we came up with, Suzanne is the closest to A Stairway to Heaven, which is Bird on the Wire.
Wow, that's interesting. I'm surprised, to be honest with you.
Me too, yeah.
All right, is there anything else we want to hit before we move on to our picks?
Well, this is interesting. When you look at songs that he's done, covers he's done in concert, he does Whither Thou Goest, originally by Lori Loman, more of a piece of poetry than a song. Save the Last Dance for Me by the Drifters. I would love to hear him do that. Passing Through by Pete Seeger. As Time Goes by Rudy Valley.
I could totally hear him doing that one.
Yeah, right. That's interesting. That's really, really cool. And I don't remember him doing any covers other than he does that that version of Always by Irving Berlin on one of his albums.
Yeah.
And that's really good. That's such a great cover because it feels like it is them in a studio. How much time can we eat up playing the song? You want to do another chorus? And he's even saying that in there. All right, we'll do one more. Let's do one more. he's chatting with the band and they're like, yeah, let's do it again.
And then David Lee Roth did it to a different effect when they recorded, Van Halen 2? And there's all that talking with the guys in the studio.
Really?
Yeah, in the booth. It's pretty funny.
Yeah. Very cool. All right, let's get to our five.
You go first.
Okay. And do you want to, on this one, you and I both came up with lists of who we'd like to hear cover each of the songs. So I think as we talk about our five favorite songs, we should talk about who we'd like to hear do a cover of them too.
Yeah. I'm so glad we're doing that.
Me too. It's such a cool, cool addition to this. All right. Number one, I've mentioned it a bunch of times, but it's Famous Blue Raincoat.
My woman to a flake of your life. And when she came back, she was nobody's wife.
And it's a song, there's a connection that he has with that song to Jennifer Warnes. And I want to say that he wrote it for Jennifer Warnes, but recorded it himself as well. She came back and did an entire album of covers of Leonard Cohen songs, like an entire album called Famous Blue Raincoat. And let's see here. She was a backup singer for him in the 70s and appears on some of his songs. So first we take Manhattan, you hear Jennifer Warnes in the background and Ain't No Cure for Love. And it's so cool. But it obviously seems like, again, a very personal song written by Leonard Cohen. And for the version I'd like to hear, a cover I'd like to hear, I'm gonna throw out Neil Finn. I would love to hear Neil Finn cover any of the songs on my list or any Leonard Cohen song. But hearing Neil with very sparse accompaniment, maybe just a guitar doing a cover of Famous Blue Raincoat, I think would be amazing.
That does sound good. While you were talking, I actually came up with somebody else. Who was the guy you did the cover story on? That sang with Michael Mechanics.
Oh, Paul Carrick.
Yeah.
Yeah, he'd be good. He'd be good. I'd almost hear he'd do a great version of That Don't Make It Junk, which is a third on my list, but that's a great, he's got such a great soulful voice. Paul mm-hmm. Carrick would be amazing on any yeah. of these. All right. My second one is Going Home. And this is from his not most recent, but the album right before that called Old Ideas from 2012.
But he does say what I tell him, even though it isn't welcome. He just doesn't have the freedom to refuse. He will speak these words of wisdom like a sage, a man of vision, though he knows he's really nothing but the
and
brief
it is
elaboration
it's
of a tube.
So if Chelsea Hotel number 2 is a letter to, I guess, Janis Joplin.
Take a look, here's in my heart.
Right, exactly. Then Going Home is a letter from Leonard Cohen to himself. It's not written in letter form, but it's him kind of talking to himself and saying, you know, when I talk to Leonard, da 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 da. And it's such a great personal song. Really, really cool. And my favorite song from Old Ideas. I don't think anybody, when you're that personal in a song, I don't think anybody can do a cover of it. By the way, that one, I'm going to talk one more time. You'd think that as much as I talk about Chelsea Hotel number 2, I would have put it in my list. I probably should have. If there's an honorable mention, it's Chelsea Hotel number 2.
Well, it's not like we don't have established precedent.
Yes, exactly.
For those of them left. Yeah, but you got away, didn't you, babe? You just turn your back on the crowd. You got a way I never once heard you say, I need you.
What's really cool about Chelsea Hotel number 2 is that the very last lyric of the song is Sincerely L. Cohen. It is written as a letter, complete with a closing. And when you hear somebody cover it, you don't know if they're going to do Sincerely L. Cohen or if they're going to do an alter, do their own name.
A. Rose.
Right. Sincerely, A. Rose. Z. Berg, Elizabeth Berg from The Like, does a cover of this song. She says, Sincerely, Z. Berg and Leonard Cohen. Jonathan Colton does Sincerely, L. Cohen. He doesn't substitute his own name. And it's one of those personal choices. Like if a female artist covers a song that was originally done by a male artist, it's that personal choice of, do I change the pronouns in this song to make it reflect the opposite gender, or do I keep it as is? And it always amazes, you know, I would love to talk to an artist who
makes those choices,
wrestled with that decision. Yeah. And why they chose the direction that they did. Cause I think that's fascinating.
I stumbled upon last year, year before, I spent a bunch of time questing for heavy metal versions of ABBA tunes. And I was surprised at the choices made about give me a man after midnight.
Yeah.
Because some people left man, other people changed it to love. Some people changed it to,
really?
I mean, yeah, there are a lot of variants that was taken in that one line.
Sure.
But everybody kept the gist of the piece together, which was nice.
Interesting. Wow. I've never heard that. And I bet I've got some of those covers where they changed that lyric. Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Okay. Next one is from the In My Secret Life. I'm sorry, is from the 10 New Songs album and is That
How
Don't Make It Junk.
Call me here tonight. And how come you bother with my heart at all? Up in grace, then you put me in a place.
I'm sorry, no, it's from, yeah, it is from 10 New Songs, That Don't Make It Junk. And I was trying to look and see if there was any good background information about it, because it feels more about a longing and desolation and kind of the broken heart, specifically about pawning your diamond ring, but just because I'm pawning it, that don't make it junk. which is such a great line, but it feels so personal. And it was actually covered with, let's see here, covered by Widespread Panic.
Oh, wow. They used to tour with Blues Traveler. In fact, I saw Widespread Panic with Blues Traveler at Red Rocks.
I'm not surprised. They are, you know, that same kind of jam band.
They also covered Enter Sandman, which is weird.
Oh, really? Yeah. Wow. Okay. And I need to issue a correction. And I'm sure people who are listening to this who do know this have already corrected me on it. But it's not on Johnny that he's been collaborating with. It's Sharon Robinson who co-wrote Everybody Knows. Sharon Robinson is the one that that's on the cover of 10 new songs with him and that he's been collaborating with ever since the late 80s.
Good thing you saved all those capital emails going out.
Right. I'm sure there's so many people about to write to me and say, no, it was Sharon Robinson. Okay, well, it was Sharon Robinson, not On Johnny, although he has collaborated with On Johnny. For my cover of that, I would love to hear Paul Young. There's a song that I kind of tie to that called Soldier's Things, which was... Dang it, now I'm not going to remember who originally did Soldier's Things because it was, Tom Waits. So originally done by Tom Waits. Paul Young does this great cover of it on The Secret of Association. And it's somebody who's going through all their items at a garage sale. And they've got a box of medals and they're saying, this one's for bravery and this one's for me and everything's a dollar in this box. And because of that lyric plot, I would think that Paul Young would do a great job with that Don't Make It Junk, that kind of sad longing. Fourth song is the lead-off track.
Can I throw in my choice for that one?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. Yes, please do.
I would like to hear Toby Keith do that one because it has that shuffly drum piece. It has the lap steel. You up-tempo it a little bit, and all of a sudden, without changing one word, it's a country song.
It totally is. Yeah. I love it. That's a great choice. All right. Fourth one is The Future. This is the lead off track or the title track of the album. And it was the one that, like I said, was used in Natural Born Killers. Without looking at your list, I had picked Chris Cornell for this one because I think it's that Armageddon. It's that desolate society kind of song that I think that Chris Cornell would just have a brilliant vocal time with.
I mean, when you think about what Chris Cornell did with Billie Jean. And when you think what Chris Cornell did with that song, You Can't Change Me.
Yes.
And you put those lyrics in it, Chris Cornell's a great choice.
Tree that's left and stuffed it up the hole in your culture. Stop and say, Paul, I've seen the future, brother. It is murder.
But I'm a little bit leaning to my choice.
That's a good choice, too. You picked you had a very good suggestion for who should cover this one.
And it was Green Day. And I think that feeling of what Green Day brings to songs could really bring the lyrics to that song to life.
For sure. For sure. Yep. That's a great suggestion on that one. The last one is a song that I also mentioned earlier. It's Everybody Knows, that one from the I'm Your Man album and kind of my personal discovery of Leonard Cohen, thanks to my friend.
The fight was fixed. The poor stay poor. The rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows. Everybody knows that the boat is leaking. Everybody knows.
And of course, the great cover by Concrete Blonde. I would actually also recommend a female singer for this one, Inara George, who's the lead singer of The Bird and the Bee. She's done a couple solo albums, and I think her version of Everybody Knows would be great. She's got this honey smooth, silky voice. And when you couple that with the really sharp, sarcastic edge of the lyrics of Everybody Knows, I think it's fantastic. It would be such a great combination.
You have any thoughts on Chelsea Hotel, since it's kind of an honorary place six for you?
Yes, Chelsea Hotel. Because that's done so, it's a letter style. I would say Jason Faulkner, I think, because I love what he does with covers. I love that he transcends. And so many of the covers of Chelsea Hotel number two are dude guitar or woman with guitar backing up. And I feel like if anyone would change it up into something new, it would be Jason Faulkner.
And I think actually Ben Folds would actually do a pretty good job, because of the way it's is a letter.
Oh, yeah, right.
And
yeah,
story. Totally. I think Ben Folds could do a good job with that one.
Ah, that's great. That's a great suggestion, too.
All right, my turn.
Let's hear yours.
All right, so my number one was Bird on the Wire. And when I listened to this, again, I tried, since it was so, this was such a struggle for me to get through, just to get to the lyric, because the voice was hard, and sometimes the music is less than, I don't want to say less than spectacular, but it's not,
it's you less don't than get, spectacular.
You don't so get true. Pulled in musically, you get pulled in lyrically. In my way to be free, like the worm on a hook, like a night from some old fashioned book I have saved. And yeah. So when I listened to these, the lyrics for Bird on the Wire, first thing I realized was just how kind of fun and almost whimsical they mm-hmm. are. And then how he tries to deliver to deliver them kind of whimsically. And when I think of whimsy in music, my first thought is the double clicks. And oh, I would good. Love to yeah. hear them do a cover of this. Because it's, you know,
that would be great.
There's something about the idea of the drunk person hanging on the wire and stumbling around, and there's something about that opening piece. I'm like, oh yeah. And even rhythmically kind of falls into the stuff that they do. So
yep, they could have a lot of fun with that. I haven't thought of any of the people to cover yours. Let's see. And again, it's so hard because I think of Bird on a Wire and I think of Katie Lang's version, mm-hmm. and it's just so beautiful that it's hard for me to visualize somebody else. Dang. All right, keep going. Okay. I'll see if I come up with any of them for these.
So, and then when I listened to First We Take Manhattan, now, which is my second choice.
I'm coming to reward them. First, we take Manhattan. Then we take Berlin.
I was initially thinking, because of all the synthesizy drums and kind of techno sounds that were kind of being created underneath it, my first thought was like a band like Rammstein. Because the lyrics about first we take Manhattan, then we take Berlin. And right. it's this very aggressive stance on
it's
the music.
It's conquer the world. Yeah. Yes. Right.
And but then after the female voice kicked in, I started thinking about the band Mushroomhead. Now, Mushroomhead has a female singer in there, in Jackie LaPanza. They've got a kind of a standard metal singer with Jeffrey Nothing. And they have the growly, aggressive new metal voice with Jason Popson. So they kind of cover all three of the voices. And then they don't mind tinkering some with techno noises along with metal noises. So you could take that aggression in that stance and then have them do a version. And they've done versions of like Crazy by Steve Seal and Rumor Has It by Adele. So dabbling in singer-songwriting songs is not out of the realm of possibility for them.
Right. Well, that would be a good one. I think it does. It needs to be covered by somebody heavier than your typical alternative band, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, REM did a great job with it, but I'm with you. It needs to be someone with a harder edge.
Mm-hmm. Okay, my third one is Take This Waltz.
I, take this waltz, take this waltz, take this waltz with a clamp on its jaws.
What I like about this song is it's a true waltz, and there's mm-hmm. this kind of haunting piano piece underneath it that I think if it were a real piano, it would it would have a little bit more life to it.
Right.
But as it stands, it's still kind of a very haunting song because the waltz has a music box quality to it. So when I was thinking about people to cover this, I went one of two ways. I thought One Republic, because they actually know how to sing and they're good with different instrumentation and they could do a good version of it. But then if you drop it to a minor key and you put on Marilyn Manson doing his Sweet Dreams Are Made of These Voices, you could have a really, really off-putting and damn creepy version of Take This Waltz.
Incredibly creepy version. You know, when you brought up the piano, the first band that came to my mind that I think would do an amazing job is the band Keane. Tim Rice Oxley. I would love to hear them do a version of Take This Waltz.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be
with real piano.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be heavily instrumentated. It doesn't. It can be really sparse, but if you drop that to a minor key, it changes the entire tone of that song. Yeah. Okay, my fourth pick was Boogie Street.
And I'm back on Boogie Street.
First thing I noticed was that the female vocalist really took the lead on this and kind of carried the song. And there is the beginning of it where there's this kind of raw vocal line that's happening. And it made me think of someone like Christina Aguilera or the group of women who sang Lady Marmalade.
Okay.
Could do a version of it. And
Mia, Pink, Christina Aguilera, and
Missy Elliott?
Missy Elliott, right. Very good. That's it.
And because it's Boogie Street, of course, it'd be, again, up-tempo and let them focus on the vocal pyrotechnics that could be built into a song like this.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Yeah, you know, even just hearing the name, this doesn't sound like it would be a Leonard Cohen song.
No, it really doesn't.
You don't picture Boogie when you
hear Leonard Cohen. It was the least Boogie song I've ever heard. But there's something to it. And again, it goes back to my statement of, I feel like he's drawing up perfect blueprints for people to take and build these skyscrapers of musical goodness around
songs
them.
Songs written to be covered. Yeah, for sure.
And then the one that really stood out for me in my next pick is In My Secret Life, which for whatever reason, that was one of the first ones I heard when we started talking about doing the show. And it was one of the ones that kind of stayed with me.
No one inside, and we're still making love in my secret life. In my secret life,
and I ended up really becoming to like the song quite a bit. And not to steal one of your singers, but I really think Chris Cornell could do a really, really good version of this.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And you had him on your list before I had him on mine. So you beat me to it.
But, you know, there are other people. I think Sting could do a good version of it. As long as you have a good, solid, emotive male singer, I think you could have a good version of this. And there's tons of them out there. But when you're talking to a guy who's, you know, 45 years old, he's going to fall within a certain range. And Chris Cornell or Sting kind of hit the sweet spot of that range for me.
Right. And this is one that very prominently features Sharon Robinson.
Yeah.
She, I don't know if she co-wrote it, but she definitely performs, you know, co-performs it. So you'd almost want to have a duo on this one. And who would be...
So like the Ozzy Osbourne, Lita Ford? Close My Eyes Forever.
Yeah, it's funny. That's exactly the one I was thinking of. Yeah, it is. No, what if you did like a Monsters and Men?
Oh yeah.
And did it in that kind of more Newgrass style with the two of them.
Mm-hmm. That'd be
with
great.
Just a slower banjo and instead of it being the barn burners that their music usually is, you could have the two of them doing vocals together on it. I think that'd be really cool.
That'd be very good. Yeah. All right. Well, that brings us to the end of our picks. Anything you want to wrap up and say about Leonard Cohen?
Once you get past the music and the vocals and you just focus on the lyrics, that's why the lyric sheet, it's funny. It's like with him, I'd almost say the first time you listen to anything Leonard Cohen, read the lyrics while you're listening to the song. Here's the thing. This new album, Popular Problems, I've been listening to it a little bit. And the first thing you'll notice about it, all real instruments.
Woo-hoo!
So maybe if you're brand new to Leonard Cohen or only know about him from Everybody Knows and Hallelujah and stuff like that, start with the most recent album and then work your way backwards. And I think you'll develop the appreciation like you did of his lyrics before you start getting to the stuff that
is more of a,
just doesn't have the strong instrumentation.
Yeah. And
arrangement.
And really the key is to somehow try to think of him as a beat poet with more than a bongo drum behind him.
For sure. Yeah.
I mean, I feel like that's the core of what he is. He really is just a poet that just happens to have music playing underneath him.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. That's a great way to describe him, for sure. All right. Well, that brings us to the end of yet another Soundography. Thank you so much for tuning in.
We're going to tell him who we are doing next.
Oh, we could. Sure. next up is a show where we actually even have a special guest who helped fund our project here. It's going to be the Bay City Rollers is going to be our next episode of Soundography. And our special guest, Hammond, is?
Sandy Calora.
Nice. So excited to have Sandy on the show. It's going to be great. And this was their pick. This is, you know, if you don't like the Bay City Rollers, well, it's all on Sandy.
It's all his fault.
That's right. He's the one to blame. All right. If you want to get in touch with us, email us at soundographypodcast@gmail.com. You can also follow us at The Soundography on Twitter. Of course, everything else you can find at soundography.com. And we're putting up a playlist. You'll find that in the show notes, a Spotify playlist of all 11 songs from our Leonard Cohen playlist. We might even throw a couple of covers in there as well of some of the ones we talked about on the show, but check it out. You'll find that link there at soundography.com. I guess that's it. On behalf of Hammond Chamberlain, this is Brian Abbott saying thank you for joining us, and we'll see you next time right here on Soundography.